From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we learn about the late Matthew Hintz, a licensed artist for Harley Davidson until his untimely death in December. Now his alma mater, MIAD, has staged a retrospective of his paintings and illustrations.
Then writer Pamela Druckerman goes in search of when and how exactly she turned into a grown-up.
You kind of have this realization that if there's something you're planning to do, you know, in the future, one day, now would be a pretty nice time to get on it.
A local anti-hunger activist authors a children's book, but hopes her effort goes far beyond that.
I would say that this isn't just a book. This is a movement that we're causing that's being translated and retold through storytelling.
And Bubbler Talk answers a question about the origins of local place names like Oconomowoc. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee is awash in the sound of motorcycle engines. Riders from around the world have converged on the city to celebrate Harley-Davidson's 115th anniversary. It is an event that Matthew Hintz would have loved.
Hintz graduated from the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design in the late 1990s, and in 1998, he received a styling and graphic design internship with the company. He eventually became a licensed Harley-Davidson Motor Company artist and designed shirts and logos, graphics, medallions, and other merchandise. He also painted the motorcycles themselves.
Sadly, Matthew Hintz died suddenly and unexpectedly last December. In honor of his life and work, MIAD and Hintz's friend and colleague Adam Muir co-curated an exhibit of Hintz's artwork to celebrate his life and work.
I met Muir at the Brooke Stevens Gallery in the basement of MIAD's main building in the Third Ward to learn more.
We knew we wanted to do something kind of in coordination or somehow with the timing of the 150th anniversary of Harley-Davidson. And we're trying to think about what we can do in the city to do something special, and whatever that meant at the time, special. And one of the things that we did talk about was having an exhibit. It was like, where do we have it? Who do we tie in with? And one of our things we always talked about and was never forgotten was the connection with MIAD. With him being an alumni, myself being an alumni, and the location being downtown, kind of right in the thick of things, and having a proper gallery space that can house his large body of work was something that was always kind of in our thoughts.
And so when did you start pulling all of this together?
Relatively quickly, actually. You know, kind of after he passed, it kind of fell off the radar of you know, just things. Until Milwaukee's Institute of Art and Design reached out to me saying, hey, is this something you would definitely be interested in? And I'd say, yeah, because like I said, it was something we had kind of thought about but never put in a full plan.
So a lot of this, it's design, certainly, but there's also paintings. It's almost multimedia in the scope of it.
Yeah.
Was that how he worked?
Well, he had a day job, if you will, at Harley. So for 20 years, he actually got an internship. I believe it was in 98. So 1998, he got an internship while being a student at MIAD at Harley-Davidson. And at the time, what that kind of consisted of was kind of graphics and design and things like that, and try to assisting with the creative departments. So that's where he kind of got some of his design hands dirty, if you will. And then that kind of basically blossomed as far as new projects and work and departments he ended up working with, from styling all the way through, you know, their creative services department. So he got to design and work on logos, tank badges, patches, t-shirt graphics, things like that. You know, art was definitely his passion, but, you know, you kind of chase money too at the same time. So one thing that he ended up doing was finding an opportunity to cross those different walks of life, doing some more design things, and then his fine art. And that really kind of came in with his passion that he just basically, you know, was inspired by being around the motorcycles and just the industry and the culture working at Harley on a day-to-day basis. And that reflected into his artwork, and opportunities came up around that. So as you look around the gallery, you'll start seeing paintings that kind of featured some of the design styling aspects of these motorcycles, from classic motorcycles all the way up through modern motorcycles and even ones that currently aren't even released.
So was he actually designing future cycles, or was he representing it once it had been designed?
He was basically representing it once it had been designed. And one of the things he kind of wore on his hat, if you will, was the fact that since he was working at Juneau Avenue, he got to see new motorcycles, new designs before they were released. As soon as the bike was released the day of, he was super excited to say, hey, look, I got a painting of this thing already. So he was already working on a lot of these things. And that really kind of excited him and became like a motivation to a lot of his artwork.
How did you guys become friends?
Here at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. It's a smaller school. It's fairly tight-knit as far as the student and the student culture goes. So we were friends and from there, and then we kind of both went on and went on with our lives, if you will, and then reconnected. And he's like, hey, my artwork's really starting to take off. I'm gonna try to work with Harley to become one of their licensed artists, one of 4 to 5 in the world. And he did it. So that's when I kind of stepped in. He's like, you deal with all the operations, all the business side of things, and then that allows me just to paint. And that's all I want to focus on. So that's really kind of how our relationship ended up going.
Had you been in touch in between those times, or you just sort of had like drifted away from each other?
We did kind of drift away from each other, but our circle of friends is what kind of kept us together. So we'd show up at places or go to a friend's house, and then like we'd be like, hey.
I was going to say, because he obviously trusted you to handle the business part of this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he must have, there must have been something there where he said, yeah, this is the guy who's going to do me right on this.
Yeah, and he watched and, I don't know, he was probably spying on me for the 15 years prior, seeing what I've been doing and, and how I operate, if you will.
When you look at all of this here in the gallery, and there's some really beautiful paintings, you must miss him. It mm-hmm. must be, in some ways, very hard to look at this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, we both, without like it being planned, we both shared some of the same passions as far as like gas and oil, things that have carburetors and fuel injectors and specifically motorcycles. So, in that kind of, that culture that we both kind of shared and were inspired by in different ways, if you will, just kind of led us to be able to do fun things together. Like we would go travel, we'd go to Las Vegas, Phoenix, Tennessee, we'd go to all these shows and set up and, road trip down and, have the new paintings in the back. You could still smell the lacquer on them, as they're drying. So you got the window cracked, but it's super hot. We both just really fed off each other, I think. And I miss him every day, for sure.
Is there one particular piece in this exhibition that you keep returning to that reminds you of him the most?
I wouldn't say it's one particular piece, but there are a few. And Matt really loved a really good story. So the majority of these paintings, oddly enough, have a good story behind them. So I think some of the ones that like really capture a story, like, hey, this is the motorcycle that sat in Willie G's office down at the museum. I went down there, I worked with him, helped him on, some projects together, and I snapped a picture of it. And, this is like a remembrance of like my time working with him on a design or doing something, some collaborative, sort of project together. And then I painted his motorcycle, and this is his motorcycle, and this is, why I painted it. So it's those things like that, like the one behind us of the big red one. I think it's called Willie's Speedo. Willie's 1957. Yeah, and that's basically showing the tack and speedo that's on the tank of the motorcycle that sat in his office.
And Willie G's a painter himself.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And oddly enough, they would, you know, kind of talk about, you know, how does the business of artwork work? You know, so they would have those real conversations as Matt's exploring his artwork, and at the same time, Willie, with not only his design and drawings, but with his watercolors. They're just like, well, here, let's make prints, and how do you make it? Where do you price this stuff? And you're different than I am, but how does that work? So, and then their motivation and content of what they chose to represent in their artwork was also different, too. So they would have those conversations.
Obviously, this is going to have a lot of interest for anyone who's into motorcycles, into mm-hmm. Harleys. For people who don't necessarily care about motorcycles, what would you say to them to bring them in to see the artwork, to see the paintings, mm-hmm. to see the designs?
Well, the content of what it is, for the most part, his paintings are largely motorcycle-based. But also automotive-based, because he was also creating licensed artwork for Ford and Ford Images for several years. But the appreciation of his painterly style, outside of content, it's an impressionistic paint style. It's heavy, applied, if you were to, and the works are big. They're like, you know, 4 foot by 5 foot, you know, maybe on average. So if you were to, like, look at, you know, a 4x4 square on it, you're looking at paintbrushes and marks and layers and, you know, patterns and stuff that kind of happens with all these different colors of paint as they get built on top of each other. That in itself is art, and to be able to then translate that into a picture that when you stand back out of those, you know, 4 to 5 inch square and you kind of put it all together, it really kind of focuses in and becomes this this remarkable image.
Yeah, I mean, you can see the layering. I'm looking at the one next to Willie G's 1957, which is the Livewire prototype. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the layering of paint, it looks like both from brushes and palette knives and mm-hmm. all kinds of other things, just thick, thick, thick. But it all makes sense when you step back.
It does. It yeah. does. And that's something that he, not only is a like a paint style that he really enjoyed, but it's something that he didn't really see in this market. A lot of the stuff is that he was, you know, was kind of more in the forefront of this, like, gas and oil art, if you will. It was like realism, you know, like pictures, if you will. So he wanted to not only do something a little bit different, but do something that, you know, was definitely in his skill set, and he liked to turn pieces around quickly. So, you know, a piece might take him, you know, 40 to 60 hours, you know, versus hundreds. So, because he wanted to just continue to keep making.
Well, I love the mix of that kind of, like you say, impressionist technique mixed with the gas and oil, you mm-hmm. know, talking about motors. Because as you say, most of the time we see this stuff, if it's a painting, it's hyper-realistic. Mm-hmm. And you can almost not see a brush stroke. You can't see, even if you stand close mm-hmm. to it, but these you can absolutely see his love of paint and of color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels like fine art.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anything that, a particular one, another one you want to show me before we wrap up? That may be a little different or may not be.
Yeah. I got some down here.
Okay.
Down towards the end of the gallery. From roughly, I believe it was like 2008 or 9 up until, well, 2017, he was actually creating paintings that were then featured on the cover of all the owner's manuals of Harley-Davidson. So as you see here, as we stand here in the gallery, we have actual paintings that he did, and then, you know, little, you know, owner's manual covers. So, you know, we have the Dynas, the Wide Glides, we have all these different covers, and it really, really made it cool because the company, Harley-Davidson, was acknowledging him for his artwork and wanting to do something with it that was different. And you know, they were wearing that on their shoulders at the same time Matt was wearing, you know, Harley-Davidson on his.
Well, and owners basically got a piece of art. It was almost like getting a postcard mm-hmm. that you'd buy at a museum.
Yeah.
In this case, you're getting it on your owner's manual, and if you wanted to, you could frame it.
Yeah, you essentially could.
So and that's really cool. And I love the fact that these are close-ups of various parts of the motorcycle as opposed to the whole. It's a little more abstract, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
So he kind of focused on what might have been special on that model that year. You know, was it the cylinder head? Was it a new air filter? What was that? So he really kind of focused on the details and the styling that make Harley-Davidson motorcycles special.
Yeah, I have to say, I love these. These in particular, maybe because it, for me, it really mixes the art and the thing itself, you know.
It's a crossover between the art and the design and putting the two together.
What's happening with this exhibit once it's done here? Are you going to take it on the road at all?
Well, everything here is for sale. His death was unexpected. So his family is, you know, obviously having to deal with that as well. So like we were just talking about, these owner's manual paintings and everything in here is for sale. So we'll kind of see what happens. But this really is a retrospective of Matt, his artwork, and, you know, his love and devotion for gas and oil. So this was kind of like a pinnacle, if you will. Up until this point, his work has never been on display in this magnitude. We've shown at several different galleries. We've traveled many times all over the place, showing his artwork, but nothing, you know, to this realm has been put together. And this is a large space.
There are a lot of works here. Are there more that are not here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's still some in storage.
So if somebody misses this, they could contact you.
Yeah, and there's prints. And you got some on aluminum that we did, and then paper prints as well, limited edition. And a lot of those are signed and numbered.
So I assume any monies that are gathered here are going to the family?
Yep. It's all going straight to the family, 100%.
Well, Adam, I want to thank you so much for taking some time to tell me about this. These are wonderful paintings.
Yeah, thank you.
Matthew Hintz, Spirit of the Open Road, is on view at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design's Brooke Stevens Gallery through October 20th. We spoke with Adam Muir, who was a friend and colleague of Hintz's and the curator of this exhibit.
We'll head to Paris when we return and talk about what it really means to be a grown-up. A chat with writer Pamela Druckerman comes your way next when Lake Effect returns here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. You know how old you are chronologically, but how old are you in your mind? Most of us have ourselves frozen in time at a certain age, and for some of us, that age is a bit younger than we are now.
Well, others might feel older and wiser than their age might indicate. Writer Pamela Druckerman started getting concerned that perhaps her wisdom was not increasing at the same rate as her age, that she, as the mother of three kids living in Paris, had become a grown-up without necessarily having the street cred to go along with the title.
So the 40-something Druckerman went in search of what being a grown-up is really all about. The result is the entertaining and illuminating recent book called There Are No Grown-Ups. We reached her on the line from Paris. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how was your perception of being a grown-up shaped by your own upbringing?
I had different conceptions of grown-ups. I sometimes thought they were kind of scientists, like astronauts were grown-ups, people who could do things that seemed really hard or really technical or really scientific. I guess I defined it as anything vaguely competent that I was not able to do. And I thought grown-ups had this kind of wisdom and insight and discernment and an ability to wrap their heads around social dynamics and conversations. And they knew what was happening. I felt like I never quite had a handle on what was happening all around me. And so it was this combination of judgment and expertise, I think. That was my grown-up category. And I, you know, I rarely met actual adults who were like this. But I think I was so eager for there to be grown-ups in the world that I projected the status onto people who probably didn't even deserve it.
It's like the belief that grown-ups are the ones who did the reading.
Yeah, or who know what the reading should be.
But there's a big overlap with the concept of imposter syndrome when it comes to feeling like a grown-up.
Yes, and I think for women it's especially strong. I mean, I was struck when I was working on this book by how many incredibly accomplished women I interviewed who privately confessed, kind of when I agreed to change their name or not mention what university they taught at, that they do not feel at all qualified. I interviewed this one woman who said she doesn't think she's going to get tenure, and she certainly wouldn't blame them because she doesn't deserve tenure because everybody in her department is much smarter than she is. And I thought, you're crazy. I've read the things you've written. You're brilliant. You know. And then I thought, well, maybe I'm just confusing being a grown-up with being a man. Because, I mean, there are men with imposter syndrome, but it doesn't seem kind of baked into the recipe as much as it does with women.
Well, so I gather this kind of introspection really begins for you, and it's sort of a recurring theme through the book, with a shift in how people address you living in France. There's this shift from Mademoiselle to Madame. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of what that means in that culture?
I mean, it technically Mademoiselle means unmarried woman. But there's somehow this moment when you go from, I mean, I moved to France when I was in my early 30s, and I was Mademoiselle everywhere. And it's not like in the States, or even like it is in the South in the States. You know, people call you, you walk into a cafe just for coffee, and people will say Mademoiselle everywhere all the time. And then suddenly, around the time I turned 40, there was this really collective switch where at first it was Madame, but kind of ironically with a little wink. And then about 2 weeks later, I could swear that like every single person, every single waiter, every single stranger suddenly started calling me Madame, almost at the same time, as if they had somehow like taken a vote on it that I didn't know about. And it was so universal. I mean, I remember like a homeless person on the street calling out Madame to me and thinking, "What? That this person is like wants money from me and thinks this is polite to call me Madame." And I thought, well, I definitely do look like Madame now. And what does this mean? I mean, I don't feel any different on the inside. I kind of, you know, like, and it was so like, I still have literally like milk in my refrigerator that has not expired from the Mademoiselle days. So what kind of transformation is this? And what really has changed? Like, have I changed on the inside too? Is this just a kind of, the world is treating me like I'm a grown-up now. I could see that I couldn't get away with the same behaviors as a madame as I could as a mademoiselle. I couldn't like be sort of adorably clueless anymore, or you know, kind of run in saying, "Oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize the appointment was half an hour ago." And people look at me like I was nuts because I looked like an adult who's supposed to arrive on time and have all the correct paperwork and take care of children. But then I started to realize that actually did feel a little bit more Madame on the inside too, in some cases in bad ways, but also in some good ways too, that it wasn't just an exterior shift, that there had been a corresponding interior shift too. So the book is really exploring those changes and what they mean and what really trying to put my finger on what they are.
Well, and I wonder if it helped to be living in France at this point in your life, because the Mademoiselle to Madame shift puts things into such sharp relief where you might not have gotten that in the United States, or it might have been more subtle.
Uh-huh. Except for the selfie. The selfie is a problem. But yeah, I mean, they really put it on the table here. And it's funny because French feminists say, when I tell them about my shift and how it was a problem for me, they say, "But we've been fighting for so long to get rid of Mademoiselle." They could, because they don't really have a Ms. equivalent. So they want to be Madames in a way. But even the feminists, if you really, you know, kind of give them a glass of wine and ask them about it, they'll say, "Yeah, I wasn't thrilled to suddenly lose my Mademoiselle status."
What surprised me is that there has not been a ton of kind of broad-based academic study in this field. You sort of had to piece what people had written about a variety of aspects together.
Yeah, I mean, there has been quite a lot since the 1990s of psychological research into midlife. It's a fairly new, in quotes, period of life because lifespans have been expanding so much that, you know, in the 1950s, people weren't studying midlife because it didn't last as long. And certainly in the 1900s, midlife, you know, you were lucky if you lived to 60. But now someone who's 40 has a 50% chance of living to 95. So there's this whole chunk of time, this whole stage of life that is there to be investigated. But I would say there's quite a lot of writing and research into the neuroscience of being in your 40s and 50s, what happens to your brain then, what happens to different aspects of your personality. They study things like conscientiousness and neuroticism and other qualities. But I hadn't read anything that really described the kind of constellation of experiences that one goes through if one is somebody like me. And so I really wanted to read that book. And in order to read that book, I had to, unfortunately, go through the bother of writing that book.
Well, and I gather even within your own household, you know, your husband wasn't necessarily introspective about that particular time in life in the same way that you were.
Always looked younger than I was, which, you know, becomes, you know, I never thought about when I was a teenager. But when you're in your 30s, you think, oh, everyone still thinks I'm 25 and bartenders still ask me for my ID. And I thought, this will go on forever. And then it stopped going on. I hit the wall somehow.
Well, and you write this, and I think there's not anyone who is in their 40s that hasn't thought this at some point in their 40s that, oh my God, there's no way I can be a wonder kid anymore. You know, I
yes.
can't be developmentally ahead of things anymore.
Right. There's no, you're not a prodigy at anything in your 40s. I mean, for me, the moment was when someone younger than me was nominated to the Supreme Court. I thought, yeah. okay, there's nothing I can do.
Right.
But yeah, and there's also you kind of enter a period of life without milestones. I write this about this in the book as well, that, you know, in your teens, in your 20s, in your 30s, you're jumping through hoops. You're getting jobs, you're getting your driver's license, you're graduating, and there are all these older people who are your sort of parents or mentors really cheering you on and applauding you. And then you hit your 40s and your mentors are having their hips replaced, or they're worried about their own problems, they're retired, or they don't want to think about you anymore. And they're younger people who you're expected to mentor and to cheer on, and whether they're kids or they're your students or they're just younger people in your life. So you're kind of in this like weird, you can still accomplish things in your 40s, but you've entered this kind of, it's as if almost you've entered the future, this time of life that you've been preparing for all these years. It's like in the book, I describe it as the kind of the thing itself.
Right.
You finally entered real life. And you kind of have this realization that if there's something you're planning to do, you know, in the future, one day, now would be a pretty nice time to get on it. One of the things I say in the book is, you know, you're in your 40s when having older friends no longer makes you feel young.
Right.
Because it used to, yeah, because they're old, you know, they start to be really old and you think, oh, that's what's coming.
I feel like I was both laughing and crying all the way through this book. One of the things that was especially interesting, and I gather this is really a gender issue as much as anything, or maybe it's just that women might think about it more, is the understanding of what you want out of your wardrobe. And I found it fascinating to read how the French treat what they wear versus how Americans approach dressing in a way that suits them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I had this moment when I turned 40 where I just didn't know what to wear anymore. I would kind of stand in front of my closet for as long as I could each morning, putting things on and off and saying, that doesn't look great. That doesn't. And it wasn't that my weight had changed, or it was just like nothing quite suited me. It didn't look right next to my middle-aged or newly middle-aged face. And I think in your 40s, basic clothes, like a little black dress, or it can look a little bit too basic. You kind of get lost in it. And what I think, because I interviewed a lot of stylists and kind of fashion experts for this book, what dressing well in your 40s takes is a real understanding of yourself. You have to dress in a way that's specific to you. And it means understanding not just what you don't like about your body, which I think there's a tendency in America to, you know, we do this fat talk where we, you know, even if we're not overweight, we talk about how fat we are and other people affirm that or disagree with us. And you tend to have these kind of, women especially have these kind of no-go areas in their body that they don't even want to think about, that they're horrified by. And that doesn't work in the 40s, because you have to know you have to know your own body really well. You have to know what your assets are and dress to, show those off. For me, the moment came when I just walked into this boutique in my neighborhood and just threw myself at the mercy of the French saleswoman there, which I'd never done before, and just said, please help me. I have no idea what to wear. And she looked me over, and in about 15 minutes, she had put me in what became my new uniform. It was, I mean, I won't bore you with the specifics, but it was basically skinny jeans, a small pump, and blazers in kind of shades of navy blue. And it wasn't terribly original or unique, but I saw immediately that that's what suited my morphology, and I've worn versions of it ever since.
Can you explain the concept of, I think it's called Nunchi, and how it fits in the dynamic of growing up?
Sure. Well, Nunchi is a Korean word, which I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, which means the ability to see clearly what's happening, to read unspoken signals and understand social dynamics without them being spelled out for you, and kind of understanding what other people want and are experiencing without them telling you. And I read a lot of studies on versions of Nunchi. It's a highly prized quality in East Asian cultures, not just in Korea, but also in Japan and elsewhere. And it's not a quality that Americans emphasize, and certainly not that American parents emphasize when they're raising kids. What we emphasize, these studies show, is understanding our own experience and our own preferences and what we like to do and read and eat. Whereas in an East Asian setting or culture, people might be very alert to what's happening in the surrounding social dynamics. In America, we're much more focused on ourselves, and that gives us a different reading of what happens, a different sense of things.
Would you think that Americans could do with a little more dose of Nunchi?
Well, I learned about Nunchi because I have a friend who was born in Korea but raised in California, and she said her parents are constantly complaining that she doesn't have good enough Nunchi and she should just kind of read the room a little bit more. And she said that's a complaint that a lot of Korean parents have about their American-raised kids. And yeah, I think my Nunchi has improved as I've gotten older, because as you get older, even as an American, your level of neuroticism declines, and that kind of opens the channel for you to have a better sense of what's happening with other people and know what they're thinking.
Do you feel like you're happier or maybe more at ease with yourself for having gone through the process of writing this book?
I think absolutely. I mean, I really, at one point when I was writing this book, I kind of locked myself in a hotel room for about 10 days, and I said, I'm not coming out of this room until I've created some order and figured out kind of the structure of my own childhood so I could tell the story and understand where I came from. And I did that. And I feel like it might not be the only version of what happened to me growing up, but it's one that I'm glad to have in my pocket now. And I feel wiser for having written the book.
Well, I think all of us kind of feel wiser for having read it.
Oh, that's very sweet of you, Mitch. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And let's talk again.
Thank you.
Pamela Druckerman is the author of There Are No Grown-Ups, A Midlife Coming-of-Age Story. We reached her via Skype from her home in Paris. She's also the author of several other books, including Bringing Up Bebe, One American Mother Discovers the Wisdom of French Parenting.
A quick break now, and then we'll learn about how a local woman is bringing kids into the conversation about hunger and nutrition issues. Stay tuned for that story when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. You probably know people who live their jobs. Raina Andrews would probably fall in that category. By day, she directs outreach for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, which describes itself as the leading hunger relief organization in the state.
But Andrews' work doesn't stop there. She's taken on the mantle of public health ambassador, through which she says she hopes to help solve hunger rather than just feed the hungry. Recently, Andrews decided to draw kids into the conversation. She's the author of a new children's book entitled Alex McGreen and the Tale of the Mysterious Kale.
Andrews, along with the book's illustrator, Brian Bostofka, met Lake Effect Susan Bentz outside a hoop house filled with growing kale. Andrews began by explaining how their collaboration came about.
So Brian and I teamed up through a mutual friend. I originally had a publisher, and that friend kept on saying, you know, I've got a colleague of mine who really, really is digging this concept and would love to work on your children's book. I said, well, you know, I already have someone, but he was really persistent. And I said, well, let me see his work. And it came out to be Brian. And when I saw his work, I was just really drawn to it. And I said, I have to work with him. I've got to meet him. And
virtually,
right. Because today is actually our first time meeting in person. And I feel like we're family, like I've known him forever, because he really got me. He got the concepts, and this book would not be the same without him.
So what is it about Raina, Brian? What do you get about her?
Sure. I can totally understand her passion. So just meeting Raina, you can tell right away that she's very passionate, but passionate about everything that she does, and was very passionate about the book from the get-go, which is exciting and invigorating and got me excited as well. I think we teamed up really well to bring the characters to life and make them what they are. She's very complimentary, which is always nice to hear when you're creating stuff. So
yeah. Even if she wants a little tweak, Brian, that's just perfect. But
yeah. It would be even perfecter. You always have to sandwich it. Yeah. Oh, this is great, Brian. You know, I really like this, but, you know, can you make her hair just a little bit bigger?
Yeah. And she does have big, beautiful hair. So where did Alex McGreen come from? Is she you?
You know, everyone says that Alex McGreen looks like me, but I thought it was very important to have the protagonist be a young African-American girl, one, because of the community that I work with on a daily basis. I think in the food literacy space, and specifically in the food security space, there are so many Alex McGreens that don't get their story told about why eating healthy is important, or having the protagonist be a superhero that's an African-American little girl. And so having that representation really mattered to me. Alex McGreen is because I love the name Alexandra, and McGreen because she's eats a lot of greens. I wish I had something sexier to say about her.
How did the story begin to come to you?
So prior to writing the book, I was doing a lot of food literacy around lead awareness in our community, and really the lead epidemic that was happening predominantly on the north side in our city due to the replacement of the lateral lines in older homes. And so I was going to community health clinics and doing education around why it's important for us to eat superfoods like dark leafy vegetables. And adults got it, but I wanted to really change the habits of our next generation, and I wanted to create a legacy that would live on. And so I thought, what better way through a children's book where I boil it down to the most basic concept that a child could get it. And kale, I go kale crazy. I love kale and everything. And so I looked at kale as a gateway veggie.
Gateway veggie, that's meaning, great. Well, it's delicious and
it's
hey,
good
you
for
know?
You. Absolutely. Yeah. So whenever I give a child a book and I sign it, I said, remember to eat your veggies because they bring out your superpowers. Because the power of kale is that it's able to draw out a lot of the toxins in our body, because lead is found in bottled water. It's a naturally occurring mineral, but there's superfoods like kale and spinach that's able to draw it out. And I mean, Popeye already had spinach, so I went with kale.
Yeah, smart.
So what did you learn, or did you learn things in the process of all this, Brian? Not only, you know, working with a new person, but, you know, what else?
It's my first time ever really doing a kid's book. I did one just for our family, just for fun. So I had a practice round in a way, but this was really the first time putting that together. So techniques and the way that I did things, the process behind it, artistically was new to me.
So meaning what, the way that you did things?
Sure. So the first step would be that I just sketched out a picture in a sketch pad or on a piece of drawing paper, and took a quality photo of it, uploaded to the computer, and then used Photoshop and online tools to add the color and the depth and backgrounds. And that process was the first time I went through that. So I learned a lot and got better as the process went along.
In developing the story, Raina, did you talk with kids, or do you hang out with kids, or is this just all coming out of you?
So this is really reality meets fiction. So I served as a board chair of a local charter school, and there was lead in our water, and for over a year, our students were unable to drink out of the water fountains. And so that's why it started with Alex McGreen in her fifth grade class, and they find lead and they send them home. And we did something very similar, and the lead issue was never really fixed, right? And so what this book, how it pivots, is that Alex takes on the health and well-being of her classmates. And so that's where it was really born, is out of a real-world situation.
Have you taken that book to that school? And, you know, what has the reaction been, not just among the kids, but the adults?
Absolutely. So I brought it back to the charter school where I was the chairwoman, and the principal absolutely loved it. The students enjoy it, although it's at a sixth grade, seventh grade level, but they can see themselves in the book. They love the illustrations. They enjoy the story. And whenever I do readings, I just can't read a book. I have to recreate it, generate questions, get young people to problem solve and think about, if you were Alex McGreen, what would you have done in this situation?
You've said that you want everyone to have this book. This is early in your book's life, but what do you see happening so far? What are the challenges that you and others who care so passionately about this issue face in making a difference?
I would say that this isn't just a book. This is a movement that we're causing that's being translated and retold through storytelling. And the challenges that we're up against with any movement is having people understand it, not boiling it down to the most simplest, making it so simple that, oh, we could do this, but also understanding the complexity of food insecurity and nutrition and the advertising world that, you know, the pros and cons, the fight, right? And so the challenges that I've come up against is duplicating myself to spread the word. And so I've worked with high school students to teach them how to read to young people. They know how to read, right? But to truly do storytelling and recreating the characters and creating that piece of engagement. And also being able to have this book be accessible to the masses.
I think one thing that Raina might not have touched on was the sense of community that happens in the book.
Right.
It is a lot about eating healthy and educating kids about that, but it's also about joining together for a positive cause, and that's what Alex and her mother do, and thinking about people more than yourself, and I think that's a really important message. And Raina was talking about storytelling and just kids' books in general, and I think this is the perfect tool for her mission and her movement, because kids' books and storytelling, yeah, it's wonderful to be able to tell the story, right? It's great, but what it really does is it opens up an avenue for conversation with kids, and it's a fun way to do that. So you can start conversations that aren't always easy to talk about or to bring up, or that aren't always interesting to kids. It's a way to start that and spark that flame.
I'm totally agreeing. I'm nodding to everything Brian says. I'm like, yes, that's it. Thank you. I think I would really look at...
You should have really met sooner.
That's what I'm thinking. I mean, Brian has been an extraordinary partner in this, not only as an illustrator, but really as a thought partner, as in, hey, have you considered this? You know, I caught that. It's like, you know, I'm not really connecting the dots here. And so as you swim in the literature for so long, having that fresh perspective was really refreshing and helpful to have some new eyes on it and to be able to be open enough and confident to provide that feedback without me being, this is my writing. I wrote this. So I'm not going to change it. And so we really had that give-get that was perfect.
Did the process take you places that you didn't expect?
Absolutely. This process completely stretched me, because I figured I was going to sit down, I was going to write a book, he was going to illustrate, we were going to get published. We're going to do this in 6 months, right?
And it was?
It was 6 months.
Yeah, we did it in about 6 months.
Oh, yeah. My God, you show up.
And it typically takes about a year or two to get a book like this done. And so, I mean, I don't know how Brian would describe me, but he's like, you're pushing too hard. Yeah. I've got a family. But for me, it was about the movement and momentum, and I just had the laser focus on this. It's like, we've got to get it done. And Brian being the artist that he is, he's like, it's got to feel right. It's got to be right. Like, I'm not going to put out junk. And I'm so happy that we both stood firm on our commitments to have such an exceptional product.
So what do you hope that this book accomplishes?
Well, in the next year, I'd really like for this book to not only have a market penetration seriously throughout Wisconsin, but really throughout the country. I thought what was really exciting is just earlier this week, I got a call from a Catholic school principal out of Kansas City, Missouri, who saw the book online. One of her girlfriends bought the book, and she wants it in her classroom, and she wants me to Skype in to read it to our kids. And so this is what I mean by having a healthy food movement, having kids get rerouted to the source of their food. She says we have aquaponics, we have kale hoop gardens, we have a vertical garden in our school, we have the chef who makes kale chips. I mean, and the young lady looks like our student population. So for me, it's so important that young people see themselves in this book. I mean, whether it's ethnic, whether it's from a character, or whether it's whatever it is, I want people to see themselves, and I really want this to truly be a legacy for the next generation to reconnect them to the source of their food.
At WUWM.com, you'll find more about Alex McGreen and the Tale of the Mysterious Kale, as well as a link to the TEDx talk that author Raina Andrews mentioned in her conversation with Lake Effect Susan Pence.
We'll take one last break, and then Bubbler Talk helps explain the origins of some local place names. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Emily Files. When you look at a map of Wisconsin, it's covered in names that remind us of the country's original inhabitants. Milwaukee, Wauwatosa, Waukesha, Kinnickinnick. Those are all words derived from Native American languages. Another is Oconomowoc, about 30 miles west of Milwaukee. This week's Bubbler Talk questioner, Jeff Diddle, moved there about 6 years ago.
There's a couple dozen lakes, and some of them have English names like Pine Lake and Beaver Lake and whatnot, but some of them have really unique Native American names.
Such as Nagawicca, Okachi, and of course, Oconomowoc. Jeff says he's wondered for a while what they mean. So I asked two experts.
Minnesota and Donjiba, Kinomage Oma, Minowaking, Nongam. My name's Margaret Noden, and I am originally from Minnesota, but I teach here in the Milwaukee area. I live in Thiensville near Mequon and teach on campus at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
Mission Zimmerman Jr. Megan Indishnakas, Minowago, Yukonomage on the way they Nishnabe, Gikano, Madi, Wagamagong, Migo, Ishitamagok, Benaswe, Oldenong, Minawago, Indadaoma, Mi Thiensville, Migasian Kade, Jaganashamong. My name is Michael Zimmerman, and I teach at the Indian Community School in Franklin, and I live in Thiensville.
Zimmerman is a member of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi, and Noden is a descendant of the Lake Superior Chippewa. They both speak Anishinaabe Mowin, an umbrella term for closely connected Potawatomi, Ojibwe, and Odawa languages. Today, Wisconsin is home to 11 federally recognized tribes. Noden says the oldest is the Menominee.
We have Ho-Chunk, Potawatomi, and Menominee as the primary stewards of the space that we're in now, but the Mohicans, the Oneida, other folks moved into the place later.
She says many of the place names in this area can be traced to Ojibwe words. Noden explains those names stuck because the Ojibwe tribes were heavily involved in mapping and trade with settlers beginning in the 1600s. But Noden says other tribes may have different definitions for certain names. Let's get back to the word our Bubbler Talk questioner was curious about, Oconomowoc.
Oconomowoc means they are building dams, and it's referring to beavers.
Zimmerman explains the two other lake names Jeff Diddle wondered about.
Okachi means it is small, so it's talking about something being very small out that way. I don't like to really say why it was given that name. The other word, Nagawika, Nagawi is sand. Nagawika means a lot of sand.
Diddle was most surprised by the meaning of Okachi.
I live right across street from Okachi Lake, and it's out of all the couple dozen lakes out here, it's one of the bigger ones. And for me to find out that it means small, I wonder what they're referring to.
And that's the question for many Native American place names. The literal meaning is one thing, the story behind it is another. Here's Margaret Noden.
Yeah, I always think it's interesting because you really can't tell whether it was a story they're trying to tell, an incident that happened there, a person who might have had that name,
or that's how they describe the place, it's very hard to know what it might have been for certain.
Noden says this discussion reminds her of a quote from a Potawatomi author named Simon Pokagan. He wrote this more than 100 years ago. Quote, "It is indeed mortifying for me to consider that outside of the proper names of lakes, streams, and places, our language is being almost entirely ignored by the incoming race," end quote. And it wasn't just ignored, but actively repressed and even considered a crime by the white authorities that now governed their land.
Many generations of adults would not want to have their children put in the position of being threatened by speaking this language.
Noden and Zimmerman did not learn Anishinaabe Mohin growing up. They had to seek it out themselves as adults. Now they both teach Indigenous languages, Noden to college students and Zimmerman to elementary classes. Their students will know Anishinaabe Mohin beyond the names of streets, cities, and lakes.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk. Bubbler Talk is a regular series from WUWM and Lake Effect, and it wraps up the Friday edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski and assistant producer Maddie Andre.
Additional reporting comes from Susan Bentz, Taryn Powell, Emily Files, and Chuck Kornbach, and digital producer Lauren Sigfusson. Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor, and Jason Reavy is our audio engineer. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and do be with us tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.